This is Greg Peterson with the Colorado Ag Water Alliance. Today I'm speaking with John Colance, who is an attorney with Otis and Bedingfield LLC and focuses on environmental and natural resources law. Today we're going to be talking about the Clean Water Act. Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Greg?
I'm doing well, and thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me join you today. I appreciate that as well.
So in 1972, the Clean Water Act defined which waterways are subject to federal regulation. But those definitions have been contested for decades. So when we say federal regulation, what do we mean?
Well, in its simplest terms, it's really just answering to federal authorities as opposed to state or local authorities. But it's a little more nuanced than that under the Act, and to get a better perspective of what that means, it's helpful to understand a bit about the history of how the Act came about. A few of our environmental regulatory programs trace their roots back to the 19th century, like the Clean Water Act does, and the Army Corps of Engineers was an early player in all of this. So Congress created the Corps in 1802 to build frontier forts and other defense facilities. But within a couple of decades, they had expanded the Corps' authority to promoting navigation through river and harbor improvements. So keep in mind, back then, waterways were important highways of commerce. By the 1880s, Congress expanded the Corps' authority and gave them authority over the placement of materials in waterways that could impede navigation. And this basically responded to a concern that states and territories could construct dams and bridges and other navigational obstructions with no federal input. And then you get to the end of that century, 1899, Congress passed the Rivers and Harbors Act, which is also called the Refuse Act, and it broadened the Corps' authority even further to reach all of the nation's navigable waters and their tributaries, regardless of whether a discharge actually impeded navigation. And it applied to all kinds of materials, all kinds of wastes or wet refuse. So it started looking a lot more like a water pollution control statute. And in fact, it was sort of rediscovered in the 1960s and used to criminally prosecute Standard Oil for spilling gasoline in a river in Florida. That legislation was followed by numerous federal legislative efforts to control water pollution over the ensuing decades of the 20th century. None of those was really very effective. They tended to be more federal support of state efforts at water pollution control maybe in research or financial assistance. But a recurring theme in the underlying debate about these legislative attempts was whether water pollution was a federal issue or one that should be addressed by the states. Then you get to the 1960s and 70s. You had a major environmental movement that included the passage of a lot of the iconic environmental laws we have today. In 1970 in particular, you had the passage of the Clean Air Act and NEPA, and the celebration of the first Earth Day. You also had President Nixon in that year create the Environmental Protection Agency, which to assume responsibility for all the federal environmental programs. Nixon also issued some executive orders in that year and regarding water pollution control. And one was pretty interesting. He ordered EPA and the Corps to create a joint federal permitting program for discharges that were subject to that 1899 Refuse Act. And they actually issued regulations, but before that program really got off the ground, it was kind of bogged down in litigation. Then just the next year, in 1972, Congress ended up passing what we consider the modern day Clean Water Act, and it was essentially a total rewrite of the existing statutory framework. you know, it set ambitious goals, including, oddly enough, in my opinion, the complete elimination of the discharge of pollutants by 1985. And how it was to achieve that goal and how it, you know, it still continues to try to work towards that goal today, because we obviously haven't achieved it. It relies on its keystone provision, which is often called the discharge prohibition. And it basically prohibits the discharge of a pollutant by any person except in compliance with a permit, and the Act created two permitting programs that will get you around that prohibition. One is under Section 402 of the Act, and it regulates things like wastewater discharges from sewage treatment plants under the aptly named National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. And Congress gave EPA authority over that program. The other program is under Section 404, and it regulates the discharge of dredged or fill material, and it's primarily the Corps' responsibility. You know, people often call this wetland permitting, but it applies to more than just wetlands. So you can kind of see how we got from those early legislative attempts in the 1800s to sort of where we are today.
All right. So people might be really familiar with what you mentioned, 404, and that's something we'll be talking about more. So what were the general disagreements over the coverage of the Clean Water Act?
Well, there's long been tension regarding the respective federal and state roles in water pollution control. And, you know, that was part of the debate and all those legislative efforts that led up to the 1972 amendments. And the debate plays out in the scope of the current, you know, the modern day act, and that determines the waters that it protects. The problem was that Congress didn't really clearly describe what those waters are, and that's why we find ourselves continuing to fight over that almost a half century later. The act clearly anticipates a cooperative approach between states and federal government to address water pollution, and it tries to balance the traditional power states have to regulate land and water resources with the need for national water pollution control standards. So this discharge prohibition that I mentioned a minute ago, it prohibits the discharge or the addition of a pollutant from a point source to navigable waters, and that effectively describes the scope of the act. It applies to navigable waters. One of the problems is that Congress didn't use that phrase for its commonly accepted meaning. And it defined navigable waters to mean waters of the United States, which really isn't very helpful. And Congress really, they just sort of left it up to EPA and the Corps to further define what that was. And so EPA took its first shot at defining waters of the United States, or WOTUS, all the way back in 1973, shortly after the act was passed. And the definition was fairly broad, and it focused on the use of those waters for interstate commerce. And that's because when Congress passed the Clean Water Act, it was exercising its Commerce Clause authority. That the U.S. Constitution grants Congress the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the states. That's what that regulation was based on. The Corps then took its first shot at defining WOTUS about a year later, and it issued a definition that was far less expansive than what EPA put out the previous year. The Corps was thinking more along the lines of the waters it had traditionally regulated under those other statutes I mentioned earlier. And so, not surprisingly, environmental groups sued. The court said that the Corps needed to go back and try again and issue a broader definition, and it eventually did that. It eventually, within a couple of years, issued a definition that was more similar to EPA's. So you see the basis for the confusion we have today, and it was kind of rooted in Congress's use of the term navigable to mean something different than what's typically meant and what what it sort of meant to the Corps and the previous laws it dealt with.
Well, and I guess just to follow up on that, was Congress aware of that, the confusion around the term navigable at the time, or was it more of a feeling of, well, the EPA and the Corps, they're going to figure this out?
You know, it seems that Congress was, and it seems like there was some dancing around that part of the debate. When you look at the legislative history of the act, you see they try to clarify that they are not just limiting the reach of the act to the traditional scope of what one would consider navigable waters. Why they did not make that clearer, I suspect, was, there were political considerations in that.
All right, we're going to take a quick break before we get back to the rest of our interview. This is Greg Peterson with the Colorado Ag Water Alliance speaking with John Colance about the waters of the U.S. and the Clean Water Act. And so we were just discussing the origins of the Clean Water Act, and now we're going to get more into about these different Supreme Court decisions in trying to clarify the federal jurisdiction when it comes to the Clean Water Act. So what we're talking about federal permitting and the regulation here, and what does federal regulation mean for permitting in a project? So with the discharge prohibition, there's the 402 and the 404 permitting. What projects fall under that? And if you can explain, what is the permitting process even like?
Well, I guess first of all that, the fact that a given water receives federal protection under the Clean Water Act, it doesn't necessarily mean that a proponent of a project that would discharge to a water, to a protected water, gets its permit from the federal government. But that's sort of where the act, once you have a protected water and you want to impact it with a discharge, that's what triggers the act. And then you'll go through a permitting process, either under 402 or 404, depending upon the nature of your discharge. So as I said, if you have sort of a wastewater discharge, if you operate an industrial manufacturing facility and it generates a wastewater, you proceed under 402. If you have a discharge that involves the placement of fill or dredged or fill material in a protected water, then that you proceed under Section 404. It's a little interesting. If you have a sewage treatment plant, for instance, you typically have that pipe going out to a river or a lake, and you see the point source discharge. Under 404, the point source discharge can be the machinery you're using to place the point source can be the machinery that you're using to place the dirt or fill material into a jurisdictional water. I might add that the Clean Water Act, like most of the major federal environmental statutes, allows states to administer their own programs in lieu of the federal program. So a state can implement the Clean Water Act Section 402 or 404 permitting programs as long as it can show EPA that the state's program will be at least as protective as the federal program. And in fact, Colorado does that. It implements its own Section 402 program, but it does not implement its own Section 404 program. The Corps runs that in Colorado. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, that does. Thank you. So there were a couple of important court cases in the early 2000s. SWANC, or SWANCC, and the Rapinos cases. What were the outcomes of these Supreme Court decisions?
Yeah, so in fact, there are really three key U.S. Supreme Court decisions that have applied the term waters of the United States, or WOTUS. And the first one was issued in 1985, Riverside Bayview Homes. And it addressed whether wetlands that actually abutted a traditional navigable water up in Michigan were protected by the Act. And in that case, the Supreme Court said, yes, they were, because they're inseparably bound up with navigable waters and usually have a significant effect on the quality of those waters. The court essentially said, we're going to defer to the Army Corps to determine the point at which the water ends and the land begins. Interestingly, that was a unanimous decision, 9-0, and it was, the opinion was written by Justice Byron White, who was from Colorado. The Swank case that you mentioned, that opinion was issued in 2001. Swank is actually an acronym for Solid Waste Authority of Northern Cook County, and that was in Illinois. And so in this case, this Swank wanted to expand its landfill into an adjacent abandoned sand and gravel pit that had ponded water in it. And there were, you know, this ponded water had no physical connection to other waters. And the issue was whether ponds like this are protected as WOTUS. Interestingly, the Corps' theory for jurisdiction in this case was what they call sometimes the migratory bird rule, which really wasn't a rule, but it was more of an informal interpretive statement. But remember, I said that Congress exercised the Commerce Clause powers when it passed the Act, and the agency's regulations reflected Commerce Clause concepts. So the idea behind this migratory bird rule approach is that people hunt and photograph migratory birds that cross state lines, and the people cross state lines to do this, and they spend money when they're doing this, and so this can have an impact on interstate commerce. And so the argument was there's a federal interest in maintaining water quality in those isolated waters. One of the problems with this approach is that it's incredibly expansive. The way they applied it, it covered just about every bird out there, including things like robins and doves and crows. So you kind of wonder whether it could have even captured the bird bass in your backyard. So it was quite a reach, and the Supreme Court ended up rejecting it. Notably, it was a 5-4 decision, so four justices would have supported the Corps' position in this case. And then you also mentioned Rapanos. That opinion was issued in 2006. And in that case, the court considered whether certain wetlands, again up in Michigan, that were located near ditches or man-made drains that eventually emptied into a traditional navigable water miles downstream, you know, whether those wetlands were protected as WOTUS. This decision or this opinion ended up in a 4-1-4 split among the justices that continues to confuse today. So you had four Dutch justices that dissented, and they would have supported the Corps' assertion of jurisdiction in this case. Five justices thought that the jurisdiction, Clean Water Act jurisdiction, was more limited, but they didn't all agree on the proper test to determine the scope of that jurisdiction. So you had Justice Scalia, who wrote three other justices joined him, and he wrote an opinion that said WOTUS includes only relatively permanent standing or continuously flowing bodies of water that you would ordinarily refer to as streams or oceans or rivers, lakes, things like that. He would have excluded intermittent or ephemeral streams, and he would also only cover wetlands that had a continuous surface connection to other jurisdictional waters. So his approach was pretty limited. Then you had Justice Kennedy, who agreed that the Corps' jurisdiction was more limited than it was trying to assert here, but he disagreed with Scalia's test. And so Kennedy articulated his own test, saying that wetlands are jurisdictional if they have a significant nexus with other jurisdictional waters. Lower courts have struggled to define Clean Water Act jurisdiction in the wake of that opinion, and most have applied the Kennedy significant nexus test, but some have found jurisdiction if a water meets either the Kennedy or the Scalia test. You know, so this confusion prompted the recent efforts we've seen to try to clarify the scope of jurisdiction through regulation.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back soon with John Polanski discussing waters of the U.S. All right, this is Greg Peterson with the Colorado Ag Water Alliance here with Attorney John Polanski, continuing our discussion on the Clean Water Act and waters of the U.S. So we just, John just discussed some of the conflicting Supreme Court rulings, and now really, we're going to get into some of the recent efforts that have been made at the federal level to resolve this conflict. 2015, the Obama administration, they attempt to define what water bodies fall under federal jurisdiction with Clean Water Rule. What were the main disagreements and tensions with this rule?
Yes, well, as you say, the Obama administration made a run at defining WOTUS. Mostly to clarify the confusion that Rapanos decision created. Now, the point of demarcation between covered and non-covered waters under the Clean Water Act is essentially a political choice resting sort of on a sliding scale between science and law. And the Obama rule skewed towards the science side of that scale. It was heavily criticized for being over-inclusive, encroaching on traditional state authority over land use and water resource management. And it was also criticized for a potentially complicated case-specific analysis that it would use to determine the regulatory status of certain waters out there. So, interestingly, the Obama rule dropped that Commerce Clause approach that I had mentioned in the earlier regs and based its approach on that Kennedy significant nexus test. So this rule, the Obama rule, identified waters that were categorically jurisdictional and then some that it would evaluate on a case-by-case basis using that significant nexus concept. And this case-by-case basis category seemed a lot like an attempt to merely recapture a lot of those isolated waters that were largely excluded by that Swank decision back in 2001. And, it also seemed that case-by-case significant nexus analysis was going to be pretty confusing to implement and potentially very expansive. So not too surprisingly, it generated a lot of opposition.
All right. Well, since then, we've had a couple different rules now under the Trump administration. How have these rules been different from the original Obama rule? And have they helped reconcile any of the disagreements or concerns?
Well, a lot really has gone on during the Trump administration. And in fact, just a month after President Trump took office, he issued an executive order that directed EPA and the Corps to take a look at the Obama rule and to rescind or revise it. And that order also directed the agencies to consider interpreting the term navigable waters in a manner consistent with Scalia's opinion in Rapanos. So you had the Obama rule focusing on the Kennedy opinion in Rapanos. Trump is saying, no, take a look at the Scalia approach. And so the agencies implemented this order in sort of two steps. They did issue a repeal rule, and that rule repealed the Obama rule and recodified the regulatory text that had governed prior to the Obama rule, really the 1986 rule. And that was to buy some time, because then they issued thereafter a new rule that was indeed based on the opinion of Justice Scalia in Rapanos. Now, it gets really complicated because the judicial challenges to the Obama rule and the subsequent Trump repeal rule, because of those, you ended up having different rules applying in different states across the country. The Obama rule didn't originally apply in Colorado because Colorado had joined 12 other states challenging that rule in a district court up in North Dakota, and the court said it stayed the rule until it could sort through the underlying legal challenge. Colorado, though, ended up withdrawing from that case early last year, in 2019, and then that caused the Obama rule to then apply in Colorado. And that was the case until December of last year, 2019, when that Trump repeal rule became effective. And remember, I said when that repeal rule reinstated the regulatory text that governed prior to the Obama rule. So it starts getting really complicated. The new Trump rule, also known as the Navigable Waters Protection Rule, it was to become effective June 22 of this year. And it did so in every state in the country except Colorado. So just a couple of words about that Trump rule. Whereas the Obama rule skewed towards the science side of that scale, I mentioned this new Trump rule focuses more on the legal limits of federal powers and shifts the balance of protecting or otherwise managing water resources further toward the states. And it attempts with some success to draw bright lines to make it easier to determine which waters are federally protected. But I would say some lines are brighter than others. This Trump rule identifies generally four categories that are federally protected. One would be traditional navigable waters like the Colorado River or the Great Salt Lake. Two, perennial and intermittent tributaries to those waters. Three, it covers certain lakes and ponds and impoundments. And four, it covers wetlands adjacent to other protected waters. And waters that don't fall within one of those four categories are broadly excluded from coverage. But even with that, the rule also specifically excludes 11 other categories of waters from coverage. Several of those new exclusions are particularly relevant to the ag sector, like exclusion for irrigation ditches, for prior converted cropland, artificially irrigated areas, artificial lakes and ponds, and sand and gravel pits. The new Trump rule should, it's important to understand that it is expected to noticeably decrease the ag's coverage from what we have known it to be for quite some time now.
You mentioned about a few of those specific issues like ditches that apply to agricultural producers. And I think especially here in Colorado, another one of those sources of disagreement are ephemeral streams. And what are ephemeral streams and how common are they?
Exactly. The rule now excludes ephemeral streams from jurisdiction. The Obama rule did not, and really the rule previous to the Obama rule also did not. Ephemeral streams are those that have surface water that flows or pools only in the direct response to precipitation like rain or snow. And, this exclusion, as you alluded to, is expected to be particularly relevant in the Southwest, including Colorado, which does contain a significant number of ephemeral streams. The rule, however, doesn't cover intermittent streams, and those would be streams with water flowing continuously during certain times of the year, more than in a direct response to precipitation. For example, seasonally when the groundwater table is elevated. And distinguishing between ephemeral streams, which are excluded, and intermittent streams, which are not, I think could present some challenges, especially here in Colorado. And when I said earlier that this rule attempts to draw bright lines and some are brighter than others, I would say this is one that's not so bright. But as I mentioned, this new Trump rule does not currently apply in Colorado. The state has challenged the rule, and the court granted a preliminary injunction to prevent it from applying here in Colorado until the underlying legal matter is resolved. It's worth noting that a court in California refused to issue a similar injunction to several states that had challenged the rule there. Both of these rulings, California and Colorado, are being appealed. Additionally, you got several other cases across the country that are challenging the rule, and it's still unclear how those are eventually going to affect its applicability. We also have an election coming up here soon. So clarity on this issue of Clean Water Act coverage is unfortunately probably going to remain elusive and maybe even so for years.
Okay, we have another break that we need to take, but then we'll be back soon with our discussion on Waters of the U.S. Hello, this is Greg Peterson with the Colorado Ag Water Alliance, here with Attorney John Colance talking about the Clean Water Act and Waters of the U.S. And so, John, you were just talking about the Obama and the Trump rules and how the state of Colorado has appealed the recent Trump rule on Waters of the U.S. You mentioned that there's uncertainty right now at the federal level, there's an election coming up, and the rules seem to change as often as administrations. However, earlier you mentioned that individual states, they can take over regulatory authority of the federal government, like the Army Corps of Engineers 404 Dredge and Fill Authority. In fact, I mean, Colorado, we have taken over the authority for the 402 permitting process. So, and in fact, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment attempted to do that this spring through the state legislature. How many states have gone through this route, and what were those processes like?
So you're absolutely correct. There is considerable uncertainty moving forward. As we just discussed, it's hard to keep up with the changing rules. I'll note that if the Trump rule had gone into effect in Colorado in June, like it was supposed to, it would have been the third WOTUS rule to apply in Colorado within less than a year's time. So that's tough to keep up with. But as you mentioned, states can take over the Section 404 program from the Corps. To be clear, that is not what Colorado attempted to do in the last legislative session and presumably will continue to pursue in this upcoming session. Colorado's legislative effort would create a separate permitting program to capture only waters that are slated to lose federal protection if the Trump rule becomes effective in Colorado. And because of this sort of less than total coverage, the state has promoted this new permitting program as a gap filler, which sounds kind of simple. But this program tends to raise many of the same tough issues of full Section 404 program assumption, but without the underlying regulatory structure to guide it or the potential benefits. And since it would not replace the federal program in the state, but rather create an additional program on top of that, you know, it generates further complexities as to where the federal program ends and the state program begins. In terms of the process of obtaining state assumption of 404, the process is not that complicated in that, you know, a state just has to submit an application to EPA that describes its program and includes a certification by the Attorney General that the state has adequate legal authority to carry out that described program. And as long as the state meets the 8 criteria or so, I think it's 8 that are listed in the statute, EPA then has to approve the state program. Now, there's considerable work leading up to that application, and there has to be state legislative authority to proceed with it, and then there has to be a regulatory program that's created to implement it, and that's certainly going to be a heavy lift.
Okay, well, I'm curious. So you mentioned that this is really a state gap filler program, and that would, if it made it to respond to waters that would lose coverage under the Trump rule. So it would, if we just went forward and we did have both of these programs, it would be really likely for a single project that it could encompass waters that are covered under the Trump rule, and then waters that aren't, and then there are for covered under the state gap filler program, and you're applying to, you have to go through both of those 404 processes.
Yes, I think that a project could certainly implicate both programs under certain scenarios. Some, if you have a piece of land, you know, maybe a developer has a large piece of land, with several aquatic features on it. Some of those might be covered by the new Trump rule. Some of them might be excluded. And in a situation like that, you potentially could find yourself dealing with two separate regulatory authorities and two separate programs.
Well, and so I have another question on this that you mentioned earlier, that the state has its own 402 process, correct?
Correct.
And so for the 402 permitting, how long of a process was that for the state to create their own?
You know, I have to say that I wasn't around. That happened shortly after the passage of the act. Many states did it, and you know, there's it was a popular program to take over. But I couldn't tell you off the top of my head how long that process took Colorado. I would not think it took that long. Probably a matter of a couple of years.
All right. So thank you. Are there any benefits to the state handling this regulatory authority on their own? And who needs to be involved in the discussions about creating a state program?
So the answer to your question, your second question, all stakeholders need to be involved. The regulated community, environmental interests, the regulators, they all need to be involved in any discussion about the state of Colorado assuming the federal Section 404 program. You know, without that comprehensive participation, I think such an effort would be a disaster. The answer to your second question, or your first question, is a little bit more complicated. The short answer is yes. There are benefits to a state handling this regulatory authority. And in fact, regulated interests tend to prefer more local regulation. So in this case, you know, state regulation over federal regulation. But the more complete answer requires a little more context. You know, as I mentioned before, the Clean Water Act has two permitting programs, Section 402 and 404, and you just alluded to that. Congress actually states in the act that it intends states to implement both of those programs. 47 states, including Colorado, implement the Section 402 program. Two states, Michigan and New Jersey, implement the Section 404 program. So the obvious question is, why such a big discrepancy? Yeah. Well, you know, there's been various impediments to Section 404 program assumption. One of the biggest has been the difficulty in identifying the waters that a state can regulate when it assumes Section 404 program authority. And this is because even when a state assumes full Section 404 program authority, the Corps has to still retain authority over certain waters. We call those retained waters, so that it can continue to fulfill its obligation to protect navigation under its other statutory authority. So over the years, the Corps has taken a very aggressive approach as to what waters it would continue to regulate in states that assumed 404 program authority. And a good example is Michigan. A couple of years ago, Michigan was looking to go down the road of state assumption, and it produced a report that identified the waters that the Corps would continue to regulate, the retained waters, even if that state assumed 404 program authority. The report concludes that even after Minnesota took over the program, the Corps would continue to regulate almost 92% of the total wetland acreage in the state and almost 99% of the total lake acreage in the state. So not too surprisingly, Minnesota didn't move forward with assumption at that time. Other states have, you know, reached similar conclusions. And to address this issue, the Obama administration in 2015 formed a subcommittee and charged it with recommending ways to identify those state water or those retained waters that did not create a disincentive for states to pursue Section 404 program authority. And this subcommittee issued its recommendations 3 years ago, And the Corps officially adopted the approach in July of 2018. And these recommendations, the bottom line is they significantly increase the amount of water that a state can regulate when it assumes the 404 program. And the difference it makes in Colorado is really striking. So, for example, under the old way of identifying those retained waters, if Colorado assumed Section 404 program authority, the Corps would continue to regulate thousands of miles of streams and significant areas of adjacent wetlands in the state. But under this new approach that the Corps has adopted, the Corps would retain jurisdiction over only 39 miles of the Colorado River from Grand Junction down to the state line and the Colorado portion of Navajo Reservoir. That's it. So at this point, under the new approach, state assumption would essentially eliminate Corps permitting in Colorado. And that Colorado's affected positively like that as much or more than any other state in the country.
All right, we have one more quick break, and then we'll be back to finish up our discussion on the waters of the U.S. Hello, and thank you for joining us. This is Greg Peterson with the Colorado Ag Water Alliance with Attorney John Colance talking about the Clean Water Act and waters of the U.S. And so we're almost wrapped up with our discussion here. John, we're going to get a bit more into what role do states have in assuming the 404 permitting process. We wrapped up that discussion, but what is the state of Colorado considering to do in the future?
Not really. The Colorado Department of Natural Resources evaluated state assumption back in the early 1990s, and it opted not to pursue it then. But this new approach that I mentioned, it changes things so dramatically in Colorado that it seems prudent to take another look at this point. Aside from the dramatic effect that the subcommittee's approach has here in Colorado, there are even other reasons to revisit this issue. Some people may have noticed that things have changed in Colorado since the early 1990s. And rapid growth has put significant pressure on the state's water resources. And that led to, in 2015, Colorado releasing its first water plan. And that established a framework to address the state's future water needs. Two sections of that water plan are particularly relevant in this context. Section 7.3 deals with water quality, and it recognizes the relationship between water quantity management and water quality. And states expresses the need to address these issues more holistically, to address them together. And then there's a section entitled Framework for a More Efficient Permitting Process. And it specifically identifies permitting reform as a state priority. And it's generally looking to make the permitting process more efficient, more effective, or you might say Colorado-centric, and more consistent. So with respect to consistency, there's three separate core regulatory districts that currently cover Colorado. And this, Omaha, Sacramento, Albuquerque, and this often creates inconsistencies across the state in the permitting process and associated program administration. A state program, quite simply, would eliminate that. You know, as to efficiency, when a state assumes authority over the 404 program, it takes over all program elements. So it issues permits, but it also enforces the program. It makes jurisdictional determinations. It processes permitting exemptions, and it even implements compensatory mitigation requirements. These program elements all provide an opportunity to achieve certain process efficiencies. So, for example, Colorado's water rights administration system often injects complexities into Section 404 matters. And state assumption, you know, it wouldn't remove those issues from the equation, but it would allow, for example, the Colorado state engineer to work directly with a sister state agency to resolve them. You know, the Colorado State Engineer has the expertise on these issues. And this, in theory, could provide a more efficient process. You know, it's also consistent with the section of the water plan that wants to promote a more holistic consideration of water quantity management and water quality issues. As to other efficiency considerations, it gets a bit complex. But the bottom line is, state-issued permits do not create a federal nexus that triggers ancillary federal requirements like NEPA or Section 401 water quality certification or evaluation under the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, or the National Historic Preservation Act. Now, to be clear, these issues don't disappear, but they would be handled differently under a state-assumed program, and it would take a while to work through that and figure out how to do it. But, you know, this, again, would not guarantee a more efficient process, but it certainly creates the opportunity for one. And with respect to a more effective program, you know, state assumption provides the opportunity to create a program that's tailored to Colorado's unique needs, perhaps by encouraging projects that align with the goals of the Colorado Water Plan, or just to otherwise provide a more Colorado-centric, you might say, balance between development needs and environmental protection. And so this all brings us back to the state's efforts to create this gap filler dredge and fill permitting program. This gap filler program would make up about one half of the program that the Corps currently implements in Colorado. So it's not some simple little program that could be created and administered with the snap of a finger. It's going to have its own challenges. And in fact, it raises most of the same issues that full state assumption does, but EPA has regulations that guide the state assumption process. And once you go through it, you don't end up with two programs. The state program replaces the federal program.
So with the state gap filler program, is it the Department of Natural Resources that is behind this?
It's not. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment is, as you had mentioned before, is the one behind that, the effort. And that's likely due to the state's role in the state's legal challenge to the Trump rule. There's a connection there that's a bit complicated and not something to go into here. But, you know, this should also be a part of the comprehensive stakeholder discussion. CDPHE implements the Section 402 program, as we stated before, and it does have water quality expertise. So it is certainly a logical part of the discussion. But as I mentioned before, DNR was the last entity in the state that considered state assumption back in the early 1990s. And if you look at DNR, you know, it's the home to the Colorado Water Conservation Board, which developed and is implementing the state water plan. CWCB also regulates floodplain management at the state level, and floodplain permitting is often implicated by Section 404 projects. DNR also houses Colorado Parks and Wildlife, which, you know, it has expertise in fish and wildlife, which is certainly relevant to these projects. But it, you know, it also has expertise in wetland and riparian mapping and management. And I mentioned before the state engineer's office. That's housed in DNR. And as mentioned, 404 permitting often implicates water rights. You even look at the state land board, which is under DNR. It could potentially play a role in wetland mitigation. So all of this should be a part of the greater discussion. But even with all that's going on, state gap filler program, the uncertainty that's created by all these WOTUS rules and other ongoing Clean Water Act developments that we haven't even touched on today, state assumption has somehow managed to not even be a part of the conversation. And to me, this seems like a tremendous mistake. Notably, Minnesota, Florida, Oregon, Maine, even Nebraska are working toward assumption to one degree or another, and other states are starting to make inquiries. This issue isn't going to go away, even if we have a change in administration in November. I mean, the subcommittee that was put together, recall it was put together by the Obama administration. So this is an issue that spans different administrations. I'd like to hope that we don't get a few years down the road and realize that we missed an opportunity here. And that brings up one sort of last important point. EPA is scheduled to initiate a rulemaking in August of this year that would amend its regulations that govern state assumption. And these regulations have not been substantively amended in over 30 years. This presents an excellent opportunity for stakeholders to get their questions answered about the process and how this program would be implemented, and then to suggest ways to EPA to build as much flexibility into these regulations as possible, so that if Colorado does one day to decide to pursue full Section 404 program assumption, you know, it has the maximum flexibility to create a state-centric program that best suits Colorado's needs.
All right. No, that sounds great. Well, John, I think that was a lot of information, very thorough. I appreciate it. I'm sure our listeners do. Any last comments?
You know, I might just comment that I want to make it clear that I'm not saying state assumption is definitely the answer. We don't know that because we're not having that conversation. And, you know, I can certainly see potential advantages for all stakeholders, including ag. But if at the end of the day, after you had a comprehensive discussion about it, and if the answer was it's not really desirable at this point, then that in itself is a good result. I'm not saying it's definitely the path forward, but it ought to be a part of the conversation.
No, that sounds good. Yeah, especially including the ag community in that conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you again. I really appreciate your time. This has been really informative.
You bet. I enjoyed it myself, Greg.
Thanks again, John.